Hey, this is Russell, and I work at the video store, the place that we can all go to once a week whenever it is movie night. Interesting guests pop in to rent something, and we talk about the films that they've loved across their life. All right, let's do it. Let's open up the shop. Morning, guys.
Hi.
Yo.
We have got Perrin here today. How are you, Perrin?
I'm good. How are you?
Look, man. And we've got Cole.
Yeah.
And today on the video store, our friend Brad Katzen is going to pop in to rent something today. He is a guy, funny enough, Gad knows better than all of us, who works here at the video store. But I know him from the varsity days, and he has gone on to make some films. The Domestic, which is on Amazon Prime, but today we are talking about Soweto Blaze, which is a fun stoner comedy, which is now on Netflix. It's available now. It got released on 4/20, which is very smart and imaginative of Netflix. But it's just a great chance to have a good chat with a cool dude. Ooh, and before I forget, don't forget, at the Bioscope this Thursday, so Thursday the 25th, which is the day that this episode is coming out, we are hosting a special screening of The Fall Guy, which is the new film with Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt. I watched it the other day. It is absolutely amazing. It's going to be such a great film for people. It is funny. It is an action adventure. It's a great sort of homage to the love of cinema and making movies. So that is going to be at the Bioscope. If we've got a few more tickets left, they will be on sale at thebioscope.co.za. But we are presenting it as the video store, so we'll be there to introduce it. And if you show us you are a subscriber to the show, we are going to give you your first barrel of popcorn free. But it's a nice chance for all of us to get together and meet each other and say hi. Cool. All right. Important that you know that.
Cool.
We love that.
So he's going to pop in a moment. Have you guys got something to keep you busy?
Yeah. I'll find something.
Yeah.
Something on my mind.
Perrin is relatively new to our team here. So Cole, perhaps you can just show him around.
Yeah. Did you bring your Blu-rays, dude?
You know I did.
Cool, man. Come show me your Blu-rays in the back room over there.
We're going to be here all day.
All right. Let's get into it. This is Brad Katzen popping in to rent something. How's it?
Good to be here, man. Thank you, sir.
Good old Brad.
Yeah, it's been a while.
It's been a long time, man.
I like what you've done with the place.
Thank you. You haven't seen the 44 Stanley iteration.
No, I have not. It's been it's been a long time coming. So it's been a beautiful visage to kind of take in. You know, the outer, the decor, the fountain. It's just it's got a beautiful little atmosphere to it.
It's beautiful, and like every now and again, I sort of catch myself looking at the plants that are growing up the side of the building, and these. These old vines are sort of making their way across. And, you know, you can't make that overnight.
No, completely. That's got a great...
That needs 20 years.
Yeah.
And so this shopping center has been going for 20 years.
Oh, really? Hey?
You and me are roughly the same age, eh? 85.
Yeah, let's call it 87. Kind of bordering, you know?
Oh, you're 87. Okay, you came a little later. But when we were at Varsity... 44 Stanley was like a thing.
This was the thing. It was because Melville was just down the way, and that was where like DVD Gurus as the
yes.
Remember that video store?
Gad worked at DVD Gurus.
That's where I remember Gad and also another buddy of ours had his start.
Yeah,
you know they always had the craziest little art house films, all the fringe releases,
the weird stuff.
It was that was our upbringing kind of thing.
Yeah, you had yourself a premiere last night.
I did indeed, yes.
A nice premiere for a film that is coming to?
Netflix.
All right.
4/20.
4/20.
That's the vibe.
Oh, that's on purpose.
That's on purpose, yeah.
That's amazing. Okay, because it's called Soweto Blaze.
Exactly. It's a love letter to Soweto and getting high in Soweto. That's the ethos.
That's the main thing. And you've just handed me a box that I see now has got... little buds of weed on it.
It's a little goodie bag of sorts. We gave these out at the premiere at the end of the screening.
Well, thank you for giving me one.
P- Pleasure. I'm glad to. Yeah.
I've got myself a hat. I got myself knickknacks.
It's a little. It's kind of like a. It's like a Munchies box, right?
Is this a brownie?
There's a brownie indeed.
Is it a brownie?
I guess there's only one way to find out, Russell.
Shit!
I'll leave that to you to enjoy.
I've got what looks like a big bat of weed, but it's not. It's
Or
what
is it?
This pip? What is this thing?
I don't know. Maybe you should open it. What's inside?
Is there a joint inside? Ooh!
I can neither confirm nor deny.
You gave these out at the premiere?
They may have been left for guests to find on their own accord.
But you know what? This is the change in society where this is possible.
I know.
The high school kid in me is like, oh my God, this is completely illegal.
It's wild because...
But the laws are changing.
Well, it is technically decriminalized. I mean, officially, that is the thing. It's still kind of a bit hazy on how that feels because, you know, we're in a different... It's there, but it's like, it's kind of frowned upon as opposed to like you're going straight to prison.
I remember recently it being about the fact that you could grow weed in your house and you could smoke it in your house.
Yeah, exactly. The selling stuff is still, that's where things get a bit tricky. But I think there's now different workarounds. I mean, they're popping up everywhere. Like weed stores.
I went into a place, I was in Cape Town now over the Easter weekend and behind this coffee shop.
Behind the coffee shop?
No, like, sorry, yeah. Behind the counter of this coffee shop, like in you know, where there's normally like coffee apparel or where you could buy your beans, they were selling joints.
It's
out in the open, and I was wait, are we there?
It's a new dawn, man. It's wild. So that's kind of why I needed this film to come as soon as possible, because it may become as like chilled as just going to get like a beer or something. And I needed, you know, I needed the steak still to be up. Otherwise, it's like, yeah, just
but,
a dude.
I don't know whether you've heard some of the stuff that Seth Rogen is doing, least in America. He's trying, you know, he's a famous stoner. We all know this. But he's actually trying to do some smart advocacy for now that things are changing.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many people that are in a prison in America for things like weed.
Yes, yes.
And so he's trying to change a lot of the legislation. He's doing stuff. He's a part of like,
I didn't realize actually that Seth Rogen was involved in it, but I definitely heard about how they've been looking to try and almost drop down all the charges for like a lot of the weed related cannabis misdemeanors that people have taken because it's been so overblown in the past and to where we're at now, you know, a guy who got like arrested for, you know, having a couple grams or something.
Yeah.
Seems completely unnecessary.
Yeah.
Especially today. So there's, I think, a whole bunch of people that have been arrested or like of them, they've got a criminal record that has, you know, picked up for whatever or like,
Speaking of people who have, you know, these kinds of criminal records, our mutual friend who is a worker here at the video store is good old Gaddy.
Of course. Of course.
Gad de Combes. And how's this? A show in Stellenbosch that Short Straw had to do.
Yeah.
Moments before we had to go on stage, Gad got put in jail.
Are you serious?
Because he got caught smoking a joint in the alley behind the venue. So we had to play this show last minute without keyboard, and Gad spent the night in jail.
Yeah, this is why these things have needed to, how far we've come from when that was, this was like a legitimate concern to now. It's like you can walk in, I can literally buy one.
Yeah,
front of
at
counter.
A fancy coffee shop in Cape Town.
Yeah, and it's just as chill, and you can, I mean, down in Linden, I was smoking up with some friends at a restaurant, and like we were like to the waitress, should we go? And she's like, yeah. It's chilled.
Wild. Thank you for my joint. I don't smoke a lot. There was once or twice
not yet.
Yeah, there were once or twice where I needed it to fall asleep. Not just at home by myself. When we were in the early days of the band, we were still camping often in the festival grounds. It took us one or two years before we were like, we need to get the fuck out of these festival grounds.
Roughing it a bit too much.
And, you know, at Opie Coppy, we would stay in the town in these bed and breakfasts and stuff. Just because it screws your voice. It's horrible. If you really need to perform, you can't stay in these camping grounds.
You need to be on your top as you can.
But in the early days, there was no choice, right? And I needed to get a joint from Gad to fall asleep because often especially at Daisy's, the artist camping was so close to the Red Bull tent, which
imagine.
Is just like...
it just never stops.
Till fucking 3 in the morning. So that's my relationship with weed.
Well, that's as far as it went.
I like a clarity in my life. So I don't. I drink, but I don't get smashed.
So your vices are a little bit more subdued.
Yeah, I've always thrived on sort of just having some clarity and some cohesion. Where some folks, I get it. You kind of want to.
See, I feel like the clarity comes from the, you know.
Oh no, I feel so stupid. Right. I feel like.
I mean, oh no, it hits me too. It depends. I suppose it depends on the strain of it, you know.
Cause yeah,
you've got
sure.
Like the indica is the more chill. That's the one that like.
Oh, you see, I don't even know the nuance. Yeah.
Yeah, that's like the chill one, and then sativa is what I would imagine Seth Rogen smokes, because that's like the more creative, you know, the high functioning guys who are like, you take a joint and you take a drag, and suddenly you're like spurning out fucking poetry and all of this stuff. Wow. Can we swear, by the way?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I don't know whether you've heard me do it for the last 10 minutes.
Just checking.
Tell me about Soweto Blaze then.
So Soweto Blaze is it's a wild little movie that's set in Soweto. It's shot around the area. It's sort of action romance kind of stoner comedy, very much in the vein of like if I kind of look at it, if Kevin Smith, Quentin Tarantino, and Guy Ritchie all got into like a little sexy threesome, you know, and Edgar Wright.
But in Soweto.
In Soweto, no, of course. And Edgar Wright was filming the whole thing and putting it together. And, you know, somehow they got a little love child out of it.
Okay.
This would be that
little
movie.
Stoner Soweto love child.
Exactly. That would be Soweto Blaze.
What's the quick back of the box? What's the...
So the basic story is it's about a small-time weed dealer who's looking to actually better himself and get out of the game. Okay. But he's kind of under the thumb of this corrupt cop who's, you know, trying to maximize whatever he can out of this small-time hustler, and his dim-witted friends end up kidnapping the daughter of this loan shark and stashing her in his house without him knowing. And he comes back and he kind of gets swept up into this crazy scheme of trying to like get her back without getting killed as this as all these different kind of quirky characters sort of just converge on him in his little life.
Okay.
And comic antics ensue.
Who wrote it?
I wrote it and directed it and edited it.
Okay.
So it's
very much your baby.
It's it's been in the works for, I think we've been at it since like a good couple of years, like almost 2-3 years now.
Okay.
It was selected as part of Netflix's collaboration with the NFEF. They selected about 6 projects around the end of COVID, and we got lucky. Out of like 200 submissions, we were one of the 6 selected, and they kind of gave us full passage to just do this little thing.
Is it a Netflix film?
So it's not a Netflix original film. They have
all these sort of subtle categories which make it sort of slightly different. But it's okay. But it's not just a film made that Netflix is like, yeah, sure, I'll buy it.
No, yeah, exactly.
It's something that they have created.
They helped develop it. We were involved with Indigenous as well, and they helped sort of get us through the development process. And it's been very much part of like a Netflix initiative in terms of trying to uplift a bit of the local film industry.
Yeah, and big shout out to Indigenous who have been a very big part of the Bioscope story.
Oh yeah.
Indigenous film distribution is, if the Bioscope was a film distribution company, which in the chain, for those where if it's not completely obvious, but in the chain, the very end is the exhibitor, which is what the Bioscope is. But just before the exhibitor is the distributor, which are the people who develop, buy, but distribute the films to the cinema.
Get it out there for people to like know about.
Yeah, amazing. Okay, so Indigenous have helped you through that.
Indigenous were awesome. They shout out to Helen.
Yeah, there's a woman, Helen Kun, who is
she is the
godmother of the South African film
an
industry.
God, when you get hold of her, it's a glorious moment. It's
pin
her down.
She's an incredible woman, and she came out of many years of Sturkinikor, so she knows an incredible amount, but.
Yeah.
You know, there's a subtlety to how you distribute a film because you don't want to go too wide, you don't want to go too small, you've got to get it in the right
100%,
cinemas. And, 100%. And they had to pivot quite a lot back in the day, being pre-COVID. Would do 5 or 6 South African film cinema runs a year, where now it's 1, maybe 2, because guys like yourself are very understandably doing stuff for the streamers, which makes sense. And I think it's amazing because as much as some of these South African film runs did work at the Bioscope, millions of more people are going to see your movie.
No, it's exactly great. That. It's the eternal debate of, you don't get the big screen, but you get the eyes, right?
Sure, but you got the big screen last night.
Well, that's it.
So I think there's still a place, and the Bioscope this year, funny enough, has hosted a number of Indigenous premieres, kind of similar. We could have maybe hosted yours.
Yes.
But I think maybe for you, you needed a bigger cinema, which is great.
We needed a bigger boat.
Yeah, lovely. No, there's a 100% a place for that.
Yeah, I know. It's,
and so we still have this economy, whereas the Bioscope, we still premiere these films, but now they're living in streamers, which is great.
Yeah, it's a very cool, very different kind of space. But I think, yeah, I mean, look, the unfortunate reality is that cinema is not what it used to be. I think before COVID, we had a very different landscape of how we accepted things going.
Well, and certain things were coming. So for those, what we're talking about is like pre-COVID, the writing was on the wall, but it was coming. It wasn't quite there, which was the fact that the middle...
Yeah, the mid-budget
film. The mid-budget film was getting lost.
There used to be a place for that like 10 to 15, even $25 million production. You know, there was that even I'd say like, inverted commas, the adult-oriented drama or something that was a little bit more free. You know, things that could just...
The best example is the sort of comedies we know, the sort of Will Ferrell comedies or the
Seth Rogen comedies.
The romantic comedies, those kinds of films were... Used to be a bit of a cinema event, but now those are being enjoyed at home because so much of that is available on the couch. So when COVID struck, we actually got quite a few journalists. You'd find this, I think, interesting. Mail and Guardian wrote something, Daily Maverick wrote something, and they were interviewing me going, what's the future of cinema? And I said, I think I'm going to be okay. I think I'm on the right side of evolution because I think and we're seeing it literally right now.
Yeah.
Cinema's going to go in two clear directions. A small boutique, undergroundy, cool little cinema like the Bioscope could work because we're going to have classic movie Sundays and we're going to have documentaries and 100%. Workshops and smaller filmmaker premieres and film festivals and, you know, more niche. And the other angle will be big IMAX, fucking Dune 2.
Yeah.
Where... I got it. You know, now this year we've got DCP at the Bioscope. So we can now screen these bigger studio films.
Brilliant.
And so it's a lovely addition to the Bioscope.
That's awesome.
But something like Dune 2, you put yourself in my shoes. I know we're not going to get it in week one. I don't want to get it in week one because every person like yourself and me and everyone else who loves Dune, you're going to watch it in IMAX.
Of course. Because
that's literally the optimal way to see something.
And that is a fucking cinema experience that I will never forget because I don't know about you, but Dune fucking in IMAX rocked my world. I thought that. I saw it twice. It was insane.
It was lovely. And so there are going to be those movies that are made for IMAX, and then there's going to be these smaller, more, you know, a film like Poor Things. Just needed to be on cinema.
Yeah.
I saw that it came to Disney Plus.
Me too.
I watched a little bit of it because I wanted to see what it looked like on a TV. And I was like, I think this is going to get lost.
Well, that's the thing.
In the Bioscope, it was perfect. But it didn't need to be IMAX.
No.
But it needed to be in this kind of
It still needed to be on the big screen. It's still a visual masterpiece.
Of course,
it's gorgeous. I liken it as sort of, I consider it like our contemporary Amelie. It has that same feel to me of what Amelie did for us in the 90s.
Yeah.
Poor Things has that. But it's a little bit edgier. There's a little bit more bite to it, but it's still got that same like life-affirming optimism to it.
Amelie is my high school crush film.
Really?
I've said that before, yeah. It might even be my settle down.
You're gonna go? Ooh, I was wondering if it was gonna go that far.
Yeah, I think I've married my high school crush.
It's
just
one of them.
It's just one of those.
I fooled around with her as well for a while, and it was glorious. I still think back fondly to our time together. I should give her a call again, see what she's up to. Actually.
Lovely. Okay, but how great! At the time that this episode's now come out, your film is going to be on.
It will be currently streaming.
It'll be on Netflix, which is great. So we want you to go over to it. Best enjoy it probably with a packet of knickknacks.
Definitely. Maybe get a bit of a buzz going, light up. Kick back.
Yeah.
Strongly recommended.
Lovely. Cool. Well, I think guys must just go and watch it and enjoy it. We take this little journey. I think let's go through it because we want to get to know you a bit better. We want to unlock some memories. We want to and talk about film along the way. Yeah. Where did you grow up?
So I am born and bred Joburg.
Nice.
Africa all the way.
Same
all the way, yeah, man.
Where? We're in Joburg.
Around Rosebank side.
Okay.
So that was, it's the irony, I guess, being from Rosebank, I was schooled around like Sandringham, sort of Edenvale side. So kind of getting a nice rounded.
Okay. Why?
I'm not sure. You got to ask my mom that.
What school?
I was at Sandringham.
Okay.
I went to Crawford before I was with my sisters, and my sisters weren't having a great time, so my mom pulled them out of there. And
you went to Sandringham, but you lived in Rosebank.
Yeah.
Weird.
It keeps me up at night sometimes thinking about these things.
What was the film that came to you quite early on that...
that's
you can remember.
This has been sitting with me since it was brought up all those times ago right now, because I was... It's actually something that haunts me a little bit, in that I actually don't have like the defining film that was like, this is what I want to make.
No, it certainly doesn't have to be defining, you know? But just what are the...
Well, this is the thing. So my
I'm always
dad,
curious to know what comes first in your thoughts.
Yeah, my father was like huge, like a movie buff. Like the reason I'm here is because he was showing me films before I could even talk. Like he was that...
Interesting.
Yeah, his dad, in fact, was the first person to bring a drive-in theater to Joburg, like all the like Yulong back
this
in the day.
This is grandpa.
Great grandpa. Yeah, I never even knew him, unfortunately. I never met him.
Not but your grandpa.
My dad's dad, yeah.
Yeah, so your grandpa.
That guy, okay. Yeah. I'm bad with the timelines. You fill in the family tree.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, so he... So
which drive-in?
I don't even know. It was somewhere by...
Because in our early childhood, there were still one or two that were left.
It was not one of those.
The
it
one was, that was functioning was the Veldtskoen drive-in.
Is
which
that
is
Menlyn?
No, the Veldtskoen drive-in you could see from the Mulubongwe off-ramp. So it was Randburg. It was bottom of Randburg before you get to the highway.
Interesting. I must look into this.
It's gone. It's now fucking townhouses. But then in the early days of Mabuneng, we still had the infrastructure of the Topstar drive-in, which was the mine dump in the back of the city.
Wow.
Now, just imagine this. There was a mine dump in the back of town. Just on the fringe of town, but in the south fringe.
Yeah.
And you drove up this spiraled road to a huge thing with the city below you. I mean, you cannot imagine.
That looks, sounds amazing.
How incredible it was. I used it in a student film as a location, wow. But they stopped screening there long, long, long before. And then eventually they reclaimed the land because a combination of just its value,
yeah,
because it was this mine dump. It wasn't a natural mountain, so it can be very easily excavated,
right?
And I think they also discovered that you could actually go through some of these mine dumps and still find
it's like some resources,
some resources stuff. That were sitting in these mine dumps. So it's no more, but it was this incredible sort of mountain at the back.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
When MTV Base came to DSTV and to South Africa, where for the first time we now had this MTV Africa channel
presence, yeah.
They did a launch at Topstar Drive-In with Will Smith.
Will Smith,
where he performed.
The beloved Will Smith of the 90s.
This is pre-slap Will Smith, where, you know,
simpler times.
Jiggy with it up on the Topstar Drive-In. That's wild,
that's amazing, man, yeah.
Okay, but can we think of anything that your dad might have shown you?
No, so yeah, so my building blocks were in horror. So I was like, I was being seen to some wild shit. I was watching Hellraiser when I was like 8, and it was glorious.
Okay.
I was, kind of, that it's just, well, you know, John Carpenter's like Prince of Darkness, The Thing, Evil Dead, all of those.
I only got to The Thing in lockdown.
Really?
Yeah. Dude. I somehow missed it. I was never a horror dude.
Really? No.
I can honestly say I
fucked all the way. Horror was like my jam, man. And it still is. That's kind of why, I mean, obviously with my first film, The Domestic, that was my first, like, the horrors in Africa, and I wanted to kind of explore that.
Now, Soweto Blaze, your previous film was called The Domestic.
Yes.
It's on Amazon Prime Video.
Correct. It's streaming on Amazon right now. So, you can check that out,
too. The Domestic.
Yeah. It's
horror.
Suitably intriguing little film. That one's about, like, this happily married couple whose housekeeper dies and her daughter comes. And they hire the daughter to come work for her, not realizing she's may have some nefarious intentions.
Okay.
Kind of starts trying to break them up from within. Very kind of like, very that old like Hand That Rocks the Cradle vibe, you know, that like old school 90s
Michael,
thriller.
What's that Haneke film? Funny Games.
Funny Games, yeah.
Kind of. It's like, it's a slow, unsettling horror as opposed to...
Very much. Very much. It's all about the tone and the dread. It's not jump scare city, you know. I'm not really a fan of the cheap scares, so it's trying to be a little bit more subtle in that state. But that my kind of grounding, I'd say, was pretty much watching all of those kinds of things as a kid, and just really kind of getting into the wild madness of all that stuff.
Yeah, The Thing is on Netflix, I think.
It's a masterpiece,
which is totally worth watching.
Always.
And what we've said it a few times on the show that it's this old practical effect, you know, so it's pre-CGI.
Yeah.
So when this, The Thing, shows itself, you know, and it's all these in camera. Weird, it's these weird spidery sort of extended necks, exploding
like
heads.
All this, like Lovecraftian, Cthulhu-esque, yeah. You know, cosmic horror stuff.
It's cheesy now,
yeah,
but in a delightful way. But it resonates with you more than CGI because you're watching something real, even though it is a bit cheesy. It slaps harder because there's a realness that your brain can pick up.
Exactly. There's a texture to it that you're seeing. Like, I don't know. I call it like the squelch. There's like that. You can see like the ooziness and the bloodiness
the
that's
squelch.
Coming through.
Because you don't feel that with...
Everything looks too plaster. Like, it's almost plastic. Sorry. It's more everything. Like CG, I think, just has a bit of a sheen where we've got such a... I mean, the brain is just so highly like honed into like that uncanny valley of like, I can see when this doesn't look right.
Yeah,
people can you know subconsciously you're not able to be like, okay, that's
best example is faces.
Yeah, exactly.
So when they were CGIing characters in movies, like we can immediately say, oh fuck, this looks like a video game.
Yeah.
This is not a real face.
Because
our brains are so good at reading faces.
Yeah.
So the moment they even slightly off, and this is on the highest budget, this is like Star Wars, you cannot throw any more budget into making this person's digital face.
Yeah.
It looks weird.
Completely. The Matrix, I think the second Matrix.
Yeah, yeah.
Was
it's
the
a
first
good example.
Time I remember looking at that and going, Keanu looks a little rubbery.
Can we not do this better? Yeah.
kind of
interesting.
Thing.
Okay. All right. So those kinds of horrors. Over to high school. Where were we in high school?
Your high school. I was a little slut. I'll be honest. I was jumping around. All of them. I was watching. I mean, my thing was again, like I just watched everything, right? So that was always going to be. I wasn't discriminating. I'll jump in with anything.
Where did we go to high school?
So high school was, I started at Crawford for a couple of years and then Sandringham High School was where I finished. So between that, I was,
When did you meet Gad? At Varsity?
I met Gad at Varsity, yeah, after. Right. And I got to after. So
okay, but in high school?
So high school was getting through some of the, I guess like the 70s stuff. Like Kubrick was probably when I got into like
Wild.
Clockwork Orange. And
now you see, Kubrick was very far away from me in high school. I was like
really?
Model C, fun stoner comedies. And like the most artistic I got was when I needed a friend to show me Amelie, where I was like, oh my God, we can love films that aren't in English, you know? And like just the imagination of this kind of French, you know, quirkiness. But I mean, my God, I was not into Kubrick yet.
This is the thing. So I'm curious. I'm from your side, like because I wanted to make films.
Yeah.
Like since I was a kid, it was primary school. I'm like the question, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" was always like, "I just want to make movies." I couldn't, and again, I can't remember why. I never saw a movie and went like, "I want to be the actor," or "I want to be." It was just in my head, like, "I want to be the guy who actually makes all of that stuff," kind of thing. And
that's amazing.
So it was always in my head.
And
to,
it's
like,
just so great that it literally has worked out. Because
knock on wood.
there's a handful of, you know, we all want to be Tarantino, but like we can't all be.
No, completely. And that's why you just do what you can and hopefully if I can roll the dice.
But you hear from people like yourself where it's literally that. You're like, there's no space in my brain for something else.
Well, that's it. I was all in and again, I blame my dad for better and worse. I never had a choice to do anything else. He wasn't like...
What did he do?
He worked in retail. He worked for Pick and Pay.
Okay. But loved movies.
He was just he's a crazy movie buff. He was always...
Well, I dabbled with a bunch of things. And one of them was photography, where I wanted to be a photographer. Mm. And I'll never forget meeting a guy who was the dad of a buddy. And he was a professional photographer. And we even had a band practice once in his photography studio, because it was a big enough room.
Oh, nice.
His son was in my band at one point. I thought, hey, I'm going to pick this guy's brain because he's a photographer. Mm. And he was like, just keep it a hobby, man. He's like, maybe I caught him on a bad day.
But you never want to hear.
Yeah, maybe I caught him on a bad day. But he was like, photography is one of those things where it's like the moment you need to do it professionally, you're going to get compromised before you know you're going to be taking photos of food. You got to be okay with that. But keep it as a hobby where you can still do as much photography as you possibly want and you're free to do it. So it was like, it was an interesting thing to hear because it was like, maybe you don't want to do this professionally, but I'm not saying don't do it. That was interesting.
So you could
always just grow up and be a movie buff, but you had something different.
I definitely wanted to. It's like there's something in my brain about like wanting to like break that down. Like, what does it look like to, like, how does this all come together?
It's the kids who were the engineers are the kids that took apart the VCR machine. They took apart the computer. They didn't just play it. They wanted to see how it worked. Yeah. So they opened it up and then they stared and looked at the fan and they looked at this and
then it never worked again. You're like, what the fuck did I do?
But they wanted to. They wanted to see the components. Yeah. Okay, so you saw that you were starting to see the.
So that was
components.
Yeah, and I think also like my dad managed to get like a video camera back in the day. So I was messing around with that and trying to figure out like, you know, just learning, and I was using my sisters as like little actors and trying to make little shitty movies.
Because that's the thing, is that you got to be making. You can't be talking about it. So you were making.
Yeah, and it was also like, again, around the same time that we were getting like desktop computers.
Yeah.
Do you remember getting the first computer and like...
Yeah, sure. And it was in my room.
Yeah, exactly. Mine too. I was like, oh man.
My sister didn't give a shit. My parents were like, I guess we got to get one, right? And I was like, sweet.
And then you had like Encarta. That was like all you needed to do is just, you know, click and learn about shit without the internet. It was...
Encarta was the resource.
It was the glorious time. But that then that opened up like editing software, because then like the first Premiere and like the first Photoshop, like all of that I was getting access to via like other friends and stuff.
I'll never forget a friend being like, I heard you got a CD-ROM and I want to come to your house so that I can see your CD-ROM. It's like, what? It's so silly when you think about
it.
It's
ridiculous.
Now,
and now those don't even exist. Yeah. You don't even have CD-ROM drives in your computers. DVD drives, Blu-rays.
You don't get it in your car either.
Yeah, of course. It's just a wild evolution that we've actually been able to live through, which is, crazy showing our age. But anyway, so I kind of had that. That was always like in my consciousness. So it was always about watching. Everything that I was seeing was just a version of getting me into like not learning on purpose, but just assessing and seeing like, okay, this is how this guy did that, or this is how this guy fucked that up, or kind of thing, you know?
You learn more from a bad movie than a good one.
That's what everyone
in film school.
And
you know, they tell you that.
That's like always been my ethos, where like people would be like, why the hell would you watch that shit? And I'm like, cause I want to learn what not to do when I see a movie and I'm like,
why did I leave that and feel nothing?
Yeah. I kind of like the puzzle of breaking down a shit film and going like, well, they messed this up because X, or if they'd actually fixed that up, it could have been more interesting, you know, almost like trying to revise the story yourself afterwards kind of thing. So that's always been a fun game I liked.
What were some high school films that stand out?
So yeah, definitely I'd say, Clockwork Orange. That one was
I'm busy listening to Mark Maron, you know, WTF, the podcast. He has Malcolm McDowell on.
Oh,
this week.
I'm gonna check it out. That's great.
And there's some amazing stories that this guy shares about the making of Clockwork Orange. I'll give you two, which I literally just learned this morning while I was driving to the video store. His white outfit was his cricket clothes. And
oh my god!
And him and Kubrick said, "Well, what are we going to wear? What are you going to wear?" And then Kubrick said to him, "Well, what do you have?" And he's like, "What do you mean, what I have? I'm a poor fucking actor in England. I got my jeans, I got my t-shirt,
wow,
and I got my cricket clothes." And he said, "Well, what do your cricket clothes look like? Wear them.
Just put that on."
And so he wore. This is what was kind of under his cricket garments.
You have to just appreciate something like that when it's coming from Kubrick, right? Who's renowned as the
so meticulous,
exactly.
And you think. And then the other thing, how lovely is this? When they were shooting the famous "Singing in the Rain" break-in scene, they weren't getting it right, and then eventually he said, "Can you?" Kubrick said to Malcolm McDowell, "Can you sing?" And he sort of, this is after days of trying to workshop the scene, and he says, "Yes, I can sing." And he goes, "I'm singing in the rain." And he just did that because that was the first sort of song he
came up.
And he sort of did this like sort of dance to him. And Kubrick said, "That's it." And so it's one of the most famous scenes.
Exactly.
Was hearing that "Singing in the Rain" against this break-in and this rape.
That juxtaposition is amazing.
But it just came out of that moment. Lovely.
And it's fucking amazing to hear that kind of stuff.
Because it humbles you, right?
It humbles you and it makes you realize that like, you don't have to know every little detail, you know, that all kind of like, it figures itself out.
But he's not always the savant genius. And of course, there are these things that are amazing and, you know, you can give a lot of props to these people, but... they just people that are trying to figure out a scene and something happens and you go, shit,
but
that
that's
works.
It. You can prepare as much as you like. You just, as long as you're open to those moments, right? That's I think where you get that balancing act.
Did you get a couple of that on Soweto Blaze?
I'd say like, to be honest, like half that film is that.
Is it improvised?
It's not necessarily, to a point it was improvised because a lot of the film's in Vernac. So I'd written, obviously, I wrote the script. And then when I'm workshopping with the actors, like we had a bit of a rehearsal process. And in the rehearsal, I call it like sort of semi-improv, where we'll improv other versions of a scene or how stuff can play out.
You got to get the same sort of intention out.
But always, yeah.
How would you say it?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. That's it. So it's kind of like what feels comfortable, what flows better for the actor. And
yeah, and also understanding that if you and I grew up in Bryanston or Sandringham, we didn't grow up in Soweto. So it's like we've got to make this an authentic
100%.
Story.
And they've got there's like a township tile that's used there. And I wanted it to feel authentic and obviously like, you know, as of the environment. So it was about letting that happen, but within a sort of, it was improvisation within sort of a contained space, and then taking that improv and using that and then making the improv into the scene.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like...
Yeah, a workshopped improv.
Yeah, workshopped improv. Exactly. It wasn't like hit record and then just whatever happened. It was a bit more planned, but it worked out nicely with that because, yeah, I think, you know, the ensemble of actors that we got together and the chemistry between all of them, I think is really like sort of the magic sauce in the film, like the way that everyone bounces off each other and seeing how each character kind of plays off each other, I think is a lot of the magic that really brings the story to life. Like it's really a character.
It's interesting that you've got to give some of those characters just enough time and not too much time.
Yeah,
because
completely.
when you think certain characters need to have their own film, it gets ruined because they were only good because
there's a reason.
When you saw them, they were funny.
They just need to be.
If you give them their own film, they're not that funny.
No, completely.
Because it's like, too much of them.
You can't be too liberal, but you also need to get enough so that people are either like into it or like understand what they're about. Yeah. You know, so they need to have that. And I think that's again like a Guy Ritchie does that stuff so well.
Ensemble's great for Guy Ritchie. Have you watched The Gentlemen?
About halfway through it.
The show.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great.
It's cool. I dig that. It's Guy Ritchie just letting loose of it. He's just doing his thing.
I love that those characters like hold court.
Yeah.
What Guy Ritchie's very good at doing is just getting your attention and keeping your attention while this guy tells the story.
Yeah.
Because he tells it in such a way.
Yeah.
That you have to listen to him. Everyone has to listen.
Yeah. Completely.
And he's got this Cockney accent, but he's eloquent.
Yeah.
You know, so it's the sort of common English. But there's a poetry,
yeah,
and it's this sort of lack of a better term, you know, big dick energy.
Completely, but he does it nicely because he takes you've got like you said, you've got these common criminals sprouting almost like Shakespearean, like their words are so highbrow and yet they're busy beating the shit out of a dude in like an alleyway.
But he's telling the story about how, you know, the piece of meat sirloin got named.
Yeah.
You got into that part.
Yes.
You're like, oh my God. And I sort of turned to my partner, Lizzie. She's like, do you think that's real? I was like, I think so.
I would definitely believe it. He does his research. And he's into the masculine. He's a big fan of like using that big dick energy.
Doesn't he bry for everyone?
Does he? I don't know.
I heard a story about how at the end of every day of shooting, he has a barbecue.
Oh, well, I mean, I'm sure
that was him. Okay, but promiscuous high school, lots of loves of films.
I mean, my dad, I remember him going out. I remember him going to see like Fargo back in the day, like the, you know, at cinema, like Quentin and Tarantino, like Pulp Fiction, and telling me about those, like Pulp Fiction, obviously, that was like another one that I saw like super young and blew my mind of what that
you had a cinema in your house.
I wouldn't say a cinema. It was definitely a screening room. We had a room that was dedicated to movies.
Yes,
it was that, and
it wasn't just a TV room. We all had
it was a little bigger.
Growing up, we had a TV room, but you know, it was just the TV.
Yeah, no, this had a nice. We had a surround setup. It was like again, my dad as his own passion was just that's kind of where he put his. You know, if people buy like a new car.
But you're reluctant to say it was a cinema.
Not yet. The cinema happened around high school. That became like sort of. Then we had some upgrades.
Okay.
Kind of to it.
Okay, so it was perhaps humble, but it was still the biggest screen possible.
Oh yeah, no. What you could get at the time was what we got in terms of the size of it. And what was fun was, again, it wasn't widescreen. Those TVs were 4x3. The big ones were those 4x3 things. So that also only like happened like a bit later when the cinematic language became more
wider and sort of
mainstream.
More cinematic.
Wider, pardon the pun, eh? Wider.
Yeah.
but yeah, no, so it was all about that, you know, and on the other side of it was also like, I mean, I got to see like the premiere for The Lion King, like in Joburg, like when that came out, because he was getting part of the Stukenikor and some of the suppliers and stuff for like retail. So the juxtaposition again of all those.
So you got a couple of those treats.
Yeah.
So you were one of the first people to see The Lion King.
I guess you could say that in South Africa.
But all of this was giving you privilege, but in the good way. Do you know what I mean? Like good sense of like exclusivity, a good sense of, I love it. We then go to AFTA.
So yes, high school. Yeah, then we go to AFTA. So AFTA was interesting
because you didn't finish. Why didn't you finish it AFTA?
We didn't finish it AFTA, Russell. No,
can you talk about it?
Yeah, we can talk about it for now.
What happened?
As far as I know, so I got about 2 years in, and then they kicked me out. They were not a fan of. Well, I was not a fan of some things that they were doing there.
Okay.
At the time, and let me preface, this is a long time ago.
But their sort of approach to teaching?
They were approached to writing. I studied directing and writing there, and I found very quickly that I kind of got a little frustrated with their approach to how they saw like their version of the three-act structure and just like storytelling.
Okay.
It seemed a little bit redundant.
Sure, but that could be just a little kerfuffle or exactly. a little disagreement. Why are you kicked out?
My own hubris as well. And I started.
Good that you can admit to that.
I'll take it. So we had to make some student films, and I made some films that I think that they found they weren't ready for. They weren't ready for. I leaned into the ultraviolence a little too much.
Okay, I was about to say your puppy love.
The horror
foray
stuff.
Foray into sort of crazy horror.
Kind of stood me in bad stead with him. My graduation, my last film that kind of broke the things was I spent 7 minutes having a guy get stabbed in the neck with a fork, and they called me in afterwards. And that was like, I could either repeat the year or we're done kind of thing.
It's interesting that they would fail you for that, because you would think that they would go, hey, not my cup of tea, but you know, this kind of cinema exists.
Well, that was my logic.
There's a place for this.
And I was trying to strike, I mean.
Some of the world's greatest cinema is crazy and violent.
Well,
that's
the fire.
Here we are talking about Clockwork Orange.
Yeah.
Well, which was banned and all those kinds of things. But, it's considered, at least by the time you and I were at Varsity, we would at least understand that, like, okay, there's boundaries that one pushes in art.
And that's kind of what I was trying to do.
Yeah, but, so a performance artist like Stephen Cohen, there's a place for him where he gets naked or puts cameras up his arsehole. Yeah. Like, it's not for
my
everyone.
Favorite
show. But I mean, anyone who teaches has to understand that there should be the scope for that.
That's what I like to think. And again, the reason there was a clash, I just didn't agree. I didn't think that the way they were putting that stuff across was working. So I kind of did my own thing with that. And that's where there was a bit of a breakdown.
Okay, so they were like, I think we should part ways.
Yeah, so from there it was...
Because I'd imagine that, your personality and, as you said, hubris perhaps just put some gasoline on that fire.
That probably didn't help either. It had its own flavor to it. But
I just think of someone like Ari Aster, who is the boundary pushing filmmaker of right now.
100%.
So he goes and makes Bo is Afraid, which came out to some cinemas last year.
Great.
I sat through it and I was like, I don't fucking like this at all.
You weren't not a fan?
I'm a fan of the idea. I'm a fan of the fact that this exists. I'm a fan of the fact
that it's out there.
Joaquin Phoenix sort of did this.
Yeah.
Do I like the movie? No, but that's the point.
Exactly.
He tried to make like the most confusing, uncomfortable fever dream of a film.
Yeah.
So it's not meant to be loved.
No, but
my God, did I not forget it?
It's an exercise in anxiety.
Yeah, and Midsommar as well is just this like it's that same kind of creepy horror. It's like you'll see things that you never thought you'd ever see.
Yeah.
But thank you for showing us The Line. You very much crossed it, but how magical is it that we found The Line?
And now it's gone.
And now it's desecrated.
It's great. Yeah.
And it'll never be the same again, but you just need those boundary pushes.
They've got to be there. And that's kind of, worse.
You then went on to Wits.
So then I went on to Wits and I had to start again from Wits. So my couple of years at AFA had been
The qualification didn't cross over because you're going from a sort of more of a diploma to a degree.
Yeah. So it was now I'm like
makes
a,
sense,
yeah. a BA honors degree that had to be like properly established and stuff. So then I went on to Wits, and Wits I fucking loved. I thought Wits was awesome.
Wits is great. and I did Wits. And what I loved about Wits in comparison to the After is that you were forced and sort of had to do other classes.
Yeah.
As part of your BA. So I did English literature, for example. Mm,
me too.
And how magical, right? Yeah, to hear cool. these lecturers talk
yeah.
in a way that you've never heard any other human speak. Shout out to Gerald, who was on the podcast for the Dune episode. You just learn this new language.
Yeah.
You having to walk Great Hall stairs every day, walk past where, you know, there's a Muslim celebration, there's a student uprising where you're being kicked out of classes because the fees must fall. It started as early back as,
yeah, I remember.
As our varsity time.
Definitely.
I went to a couple of Jewish things where I was listening to some guy read a passage as fast as he could.
Oh, you know
what
I'm talking about?
What is that?
I have no idea, but it sounds fun.
Do you have any Jewishness in you?
I'm Jewish.
You're Jewish.
On the holidays.
There's a certain day or celebration where you have to read a passage, and the rabbis do it in such a way where it's about reading it as fast as you can. I mean, it sounds silly, but he's going, come in.
Wow.
And he's doing it in like one breath.
I should know this, I think, but I'm terrible.
And then you'll find this hilarious. So it's a particular passage of a particular part of...
not Shabbat. I don't know if this is...
The Torah, but...
Terrible.
And there's a thing where this guy does it in such a way where he can speak so quickly and do this passage so quickly as part of this celebration. He still had some breath left over, so he had to whistle with him. And so I was sitting in this room with Claudine. Shout out to Claudine Ullman, because she took me because she was like, "You got to see this. This is interesting. This is a fascinating part of Jewish culture."
Yeah.
It was in a up room back corner of the Matrix, you know, which is the shopping student center of
all the restaurants and stuff were there.
Yeah, and so he read this passage in Hebrew. And then he wanted to show off, or at least celebrate the fact that he still had air in his lungs. So he then had this whistle. So he gave this long, 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 long passage and then went, beep, and like everyone cheered.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, what the fuck did we just watch?
I will find out what this is because now I'm very curious.
And I was just like, you could only get this from Wits.
Yeah, I love the melting
pot
of it. It's...
Because when I then had a little to do with After, I appreciated the fact that it was probably a bit closer to a film set.
Yes.
Where it's more real, it's a bit more practical, and it's a bit more hands-on. So whenever we had these student film festivals, the After films always looked a lot better. You know, because technically this was someone specializing in cinematography, or they were specializing in editing. So a lot of the times the films looked better.
Always,
but the Wits films, every now and again, were better thought through because they were coming from filmmakers that had maybe sociology, or were hanging out with the anthropology kids, or were reading English literature and getting exposed to English lit. Or, you know, we had that introductory class, which was called FEPA. Do you remember that? It became drama and film, which was like the spine subject that we had to
take which one
throughout our BA.
Yes.
And that was broken up into all the disciplines. So all the art students came together for that one.
I remember that.
And everyone hated it because everyone was like, I want to be a film student. I'm not interested in opera.
I blocked it all out, but now you're like unlocking.
And the music students were like, I don't want to learn about Italian neorealism film. This is not what I came for.
Yeah.
But then after 4 years, you're like, oh, I get it.
Yeah. No,
because
completely.
You know, architecture, there was like a little bit of architecture, or there was a little bit of performance, or a little bit of, you know, Dadaism. And you leave that going, oh my God, my brain is just so expanded.
Exactly. It helps open things. I mean, I ended up fucking studying, I did a year of sign language. Because I needed like an extra thing.
A buddy of mine at Varsity also did sign language.
And it was a wild little course, but we ended up doing like these tours to different like deaf schools and like meeting a whole bunch of like just like, again, understanding how people see the world in a different way, you know, when they're having to communicate, which in fact informed like one of our experimental films, which I did with Sam Nell, which I think we also know.
Yeah. Shout out to Sam Nell, who's a customer here at the video store.
Yeah, she's awesome. Kicks ass. And we collaborated on that together. And that was a film that we had no dialogue. We were like, let's make an experiment. Let's do a short that no dialogue, no like human characters even. It was a weird ass thing about talking boxes.
Arty.
Very art, like, completely bizarre. But it was, again, all of that kind of stuff was what I loved about Wits, in that I would never have been able to do something as outlandish at After, just because of how constrained I felt there approach.
Or you just weren't exposed to it. Didn't occur to you because nobody said, "Hey, do you want to do a sign language course?"
Like, see what else you can, like, you know, dabble in. I really appreciated how Vitz gave you the freedom to just. They're like, okay, you need to do this. Here are your tools. See what you can play with, and it allowed you to fuck up in interesting ways.
Vitz doesn't care about you. In the best way.
Yeah.
Like, it's up to you.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so there's none of that petty, you know, don't like the violence of your film.
Yeah, we're not watching your shoulder and, like, trying to be all, like, snooty about it. So
you'd appreciate this. One of the lecturers at Vitz said in one course, he said, "I don't want to see a gun. I don't want to see a gun in any of your films."
Okay.
Here's why. He says, "I don't think you guys understand the sheer power and effect of a gun in real life. You can prove me wrong. So if you think if you've grown up, I don't know, around the violence or the understanding of the gun, or if your film shows the sheer weight of what it means to actually hold and fire a gun, you can prove me wrong, but I don't think you have it. So don't test me.
Yeah.
Unless you're confident.
Like, the fucking gauntlet is thrown down.
Because every student film is all about fucking shooting guns at each other. And they're all, you know, because everyone thinks...
That's cool. Everyone's to be Tarantino. Everyone's trying to do the gangster...
And on that note, can we chat for a moment about Civil War? Have you seen the movie Civil War?
Have you seen it?
Yeah. We're screening it here at the Bioscope. Alex Garland's new film. And just on that note, because I don't want to get too much into it then, if you haven't seen it, is they treat the guns of this movie... The sound is different. The sound design is different. And I realized that when you watch a Die Hard or a John Wick where there's gunshots going off every second, they're loud enough to show your brain that they're gunshots, but they're a little bit muted in the sense that you're a bit desensitized.
Yeah.
And they're not that loud.
Right.
But if you've actually fired a gun in real life, have you shot a gun?
I have indeed, yes.
And you realize how fucking loud that is and how like... powerful a gun really is when you hold it. It's heavier than you think.
Yeah.
It kicks in a way that your body's not ready for. When you watch Civil War, you realize the sound design makes every gunshot piercing.
Power.
And
through.
Powerful. Anyways, we're going on a tangent.
That's
a, but it's a
I'm
lovely
excited.
Thing. Like, have you seen 1917?
Yes.
You know when that bomb goes off in the bunker, especially when you hear it in good sound.
You feel that. You feel it. You don't even. It's just. Yeah.
It's not just loud enough to be loud, but not too loud that it doesn't offend. This offends you.
No, exactly.
It rocks your body.
It's terrifying. A lot of it has also desensitized us to that.
Yeah.
Like where it's become a bit too. And I mean, again, it's like very Tarantino-esque because he's known for layering and using like authentic sounds, and then you know, like a Django Unchained. When that guy fires a pistol, it's like a cannon, and it sounds awesome, but it's not real necessarily. Yeah. You know,
interesting. What came to you around Varsity? This is our. It's getting serious.
It's getting serious, and doesn't get more serious than Kurosawa.
Oh shit!
Yeah, that was Seven Samurai was the.
Okay, so famous Japanese filmmaker Akira Kurosawa.
He was the man.
Is considered by many to be the sort of one of the godfathers of film.
If not the, yes.
And over in Japan was making these incredible films, many of which got adapted.
Yeah.
So the famous cowboy film, The Magnificent Seven.
All of that,
was a Western copy of Seven Samurai, which is a timeless classic.
Masterpiece. It was that... I remember seeing, like, 1999 was the year, right? I think.
Okay.
In terms of where things, because like, that was the year of The Matrix. That was the year of Fight Club.
Yeah,
that
was the end of the 90s.
It was the year, I mean, Magnolia.
Oh, yeah.
Like, Amelie. Just, that year is up there as one of the best years of film in history. Like, it's the amount of great films that came out.
Also, it was the year that you were a Varsity, like going into?
That was the transition. It was literally the crossover.
It was the end of high school into Varsity.
Yeah.
So it was us at our time.
Exactly.
Right? Every person would say, oh, the music of whatever era was the best in the film or whatever. That was our era.
This is why. But when you look at that list, and so that's why when I say I was a little slut about this stuff, because all of those films, as diverse as they were, was what I would say probably set me up for that.
But they really were modern classics. I mean, Fight Club is amazing.
All of
The Matrix was amazing.
Exactly. And then from there, that's kind of when, yeah, and then I kind of you start going backwards a bit, because then you hear those filmmakers talk about what they loved,
yeah,
and how, you know, what their influences were, and Kurosawa was that constant coming up. So seeing, going back, yeah,
so
to him.
So in your Varsity era, you were going back to Kurosawa. What?
All of that. Yeah. Seven Samurai, Ran, Kiru, Dreams, like all his.
Yojimbo,
exactly. I mean, yeah, that was what Sergio Leone's remake for, you know, Man with No Name trilogy was part of that. Yeah. Was all influenced by a lot, yeah, of. It was Yojimbo and the one, the remake of Macbeth that Kurosawa did, I think Blood. Something else. That,
Throne of Blood.
Yeah. That was, I think, George Lucas's influence for Star Wars.
Yeah.
So it was all the good shit that is in Western cinema started back.
Is Kurosawa accessible anywhere? Probably Mubi. Where would you want
Mubi? Yeah.
Because it's not on Netflix. Or
you can't
anything.
Get any
you
of those.
You can't get any of that stuff.
It's kind of depressing. I think there might be someone Amazon Prime, because Amazon Prime, to their credit, has a great list of old classics. Like if you look through some of their
and
stuff,
and then those are the ones you got to pay per view on, I think.
Not that I'm aware of.
Amazon's also got a bit of iTunes-ness to it, where you got to pay.
But because I've just been sometimes you just search through to see what's on there, and like similar movies or whatever it is, and I've seen a couple things come up that I'm like, oh fuck, okay, I haven't thought of this film in like 10 years.
Yeah,
good to see that one pop up. So, but at Seven Samurai, I remember being like that one was one of those, like, it's before and after. I own that film in, I think, 3 different formats. I just kept buying it. It was one of those. That, and then also Metropolis, Fritz Lang's Metropolis.
Yeah.
That was like...
And when people are comparing a lot of scenes of Metropolis to Poor Things.
Yeah.
You know, those like sort of zeppelins in the sky.
100%. I never thought about that.
And that sort of the scene of when she sort of gets the...
Yeah.
The brainwaves sort of put on her are very similar.
It's all...
The Frankensteinness of completely. Sort of bringing this thing to life.
Totally,
it's amazing how those things come back. What is a film we could settle down with?
Damn, the one that we could settle down with. You see, I'm into open relationships.
Yeah, that's fine.
When it comes to this, so it's like,
what are we dabbling with at the moment, or what are we in the mood for? Or where do we sort of see ourselves?
Yeah, I'm,
what could we tolerate?
What could we tolerate? Yeah, I want to say. I mean, what's coming to mind? Brazil, Terry Gilliam's Brazil.
Okay, I've always known about it, never seen it.
You need to line this. That needs to be lined up.
Okay.
That's and again, coming back to Poor Things, it plays in that, got that Terry Gilliam esque.
Yeah. Just help me quick. Terry Gilliam was a part of Monty Python.
So Terry Gilliam, yes, Terry Gilliam was originally in the troupe. His role in the troupe was he did all the animated segments.
Yes.
So all those, like
the big foot coming down
and all the weird little trumpets out the arse and stuff.
But he was never one of the actors.
He did sometimes. He was actually the actor in Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Yeah.
He was the dude with the coconuts.
Okay.
He's that guy.
That's Terry Gilliam.
That's
okay.
Terry Gilliam.
He's since died, hey?
No.
No, alive. Then what was the Parnassus? The
Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus. So that was an interesting story.
Who was that filmmaker?
Is Gilliam. That's also Gilliam.
But then who died and they had to finish it?
Heath Ledger.
Oh, that's right.
So the running gag for Terry Gilliam is that this guy is like the worst luck ever. Every film he's made has had like issues and problems. You know, he's like the director... punching bag for like bad times on set.
Okay.
And his so he was making, yeah, he had the Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, which was this sort of epic sort of fantasy film.
Very lecker weird. Yeah.
Yeah, very kind of wacky.
Okay, so you got halfway through it or a little way through it when Heath Ledger died.
And that's, yeah, Heath Ledger was starring in it. He passed away and then he had half a film. So again, to his credit, what he ended up managing to do is he got two other actors, Jude Law and Colin Farrell, to kind of play Heath Ledger's part
as
the same character. And it fits into the story, and it sounds weird to like what he just like halfway through suddenly Colin Farrell pops up as the same character. But the way he ties it in is actually like really smart. And for better or worse, the film is not what it probably wanted it to be, but it succeeded in its own
Okay, so
version.
What else did he make?
So he's done classics, man. He's done 12 Monkeys with Brad Pitt. And,
oh, that's right. That's one of my favorites.
Yeah.
Sorry, I knew that there was. I was closer to Gilliam than I thought.
He's got some crazy.
12 Monkeys is amazing.
It's also one of my favorite scores. One of that opening score is also seminal. But so he did that, and then he did his most notorious like failure is Don Quixote, because there's an amazing documentary called Lost in La Mancha, which anyone who's interested in like watching the back,
yeah,
the background.
There's been a few over the course of the last sort of 100 whatever years of filmmaking. There's been a few documentaries that have about the making of,
which is just as good as the film,
that have often been famously better than the film.
Yeah, okay. and at least as a compliment to like what crazy shit goes down in terms of film production and how that goes. And Lost in the Munch is like, the amount of shit. I mean, that was originally with Johnny Depp, and then
the Don Quixote.
Don Quixote was originally Johnny Depp, and he had they were shooting like in some desert area, and then they had all these sets built. There was a flash flood. All the sets got destroyed. Johnny Depp ended up getting food poisoning or something. He dropped out. They got another actor in. I think he also died, got sick. It was one after another. Yeah. Like, it's insane. He eventually finished the film, I think, like 10 years later with Adam Driver. And again, his success is debatable, but it's an amazing... It's one of those where, like, he just managed to finish it. And that's its, like, own little accomplishment in its own.
So what is special about Brazil?
So Brazil is a dystopian sort of sci-fi film that it's just... It's a beautiful satire on, like, the madness of bureaucracy and how, like, one individual can get lost in, like, the machine of... like the administrative government system, you know, and it's one of those films where it just explores sort of like the insignificance of the individual against like the state kind of thing. But he does it in this very kind of like surreal, very tragic. It's got one of the darkest endings, I think, of like any film. And it was another notorious production.
Why do you love this? Why do you love a film like that?
Because I like to see, I like to push, again, you talk about the extremes. I like to see what the extremes of the human condition can look like. I think that's, I'm kind of fascinated by what is that line? You talk about the line and erasing the line. I'm always curious to see what's the line and then how far can we go past it? Like, what does that abyss look like? And is it staring back?
Okay.
You know, what's in there? And yeah, but what's interesting, what was cool with Brazil, well, I say cool, but what was interesting is that when he screened the film, the studios freaked out and pretty much recut the ending and gave it a happy ending.
Okay.
And Terry Gilliam was like, he got locked out of the editing room. He didn't have any say in this. So he took out a full page ad in like Variety, calling out the studio and saying, "You guys have fucked up my movie." And like,
interesting that bureaucracy is what then.
It all plays out. So there's an amazing Criterion edition, which has the original ending and then the shitty studio ending, with this ridiculously happy ending that just makes like no sense in the story. But it's just an interesting counterpoint to see how these things can affect the vision of these filmmakers, you know?
Interesting. Okay.
But, yeah. So that one is, you can go back to that many times.
Well, so where is that? Once again, I don't think that's anywhere.
It's hard to get, man. Yeah. These ones, I don't know. But I haven't seen that on streaming anywhere. It's probably the Criterion. We don't have it in South Africa, but the Criterion has its own channel, you know, that's got like a streaming, like the service.
Yeah.
And they do a lot of, they've got all those films.
Yeah.
You know, but in terms of like being able to access them here legally, you may need to,
sail the seas.
See what you can find.
Didi, I'm proud of you, man.
Thank
the
you,
The little
sir.
Brad that just roped in his sisters for movies.
Yeah, just, you know, strapping fireworks to my friends and pretending they're getting shot. That was
really?
That was my high school. Yeah, it was great. They were down, just so they were all consenting to getting shot.
But like little Tom Thumbs that would sort of...
Exactly.
Sort of
we'd get some little bloods, like tomato sauce, little packets of tomato sauce.
Yeah.
And then get some of those Tom Thumb fireworks and then put them under a t-shirt. And we'd be like, all right, light it, start rolling, and then... See what
it's
happens.
Wild, yeah. Have you seen The Fablemans?
Yes, I've seen The Fablemans.
Okay, did that resonate?
It did and it didn't. It was cool. I mean, look, it's hard to relate to watching some dude's mom.
Yeah, not that part. Yes. The Fablemans is Steven Spielberg's sort of effectively his autobiography that he made himself, which is real interesting.
Which is very interesting, I agree. But no, it scratches that itch of just like the magic of filmmaking and the dream of filmmaking
and how these, you know, you, it's the 10,000 hours, just this idea that you know every great filmmaker has got these stories of them, you know, pyrotechnicking their friends, you know.
exactly
so it's just so lovely that you did do that. And it's so lovely that you've got these films that have gone. You said your short films gone went to Cannes.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, no, it was, we got very lucky.
You've got this other film on Amazon Prime, and you now got this film on Netflix, man. So you on your way.
Crazy times.
You're well on your way.
We're doing what we do, man. We're trying.
Lovely, man. I'm happy for you, and I hope all the stoners around South Africa, you know, enjoy it, and others enjoy it. Obviously,
that's the idea.
Coming out on International Stoner Day,
exactly 420.
We don't know why that's the Stoner Day, right? Famously, I had to explain this to my future in-laws. We were on a game drive, and this guy had these tattoos on his hand.
Oh,
420. We were all having sort of sundown of drinks, and I said, so what's the tattoo say? And then I noticed it immediately that it said 420. And he was like, no, I don't want to talk about it. And I was like, I know. And then everyone was like, okay, now it's a thing.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, well, let's get into it. I had to justify why I know this, that the 20th of April, because it is 420, has become this kind of day for stoners.
At 20 past four. Is like this thing.
Because it must have been like a criminal code.
Surprisingly, not that. So I'm a little shaky on the exact specifics, but essentially, from what I know, it originated in California, where there was an area that where people would go and buy weed, like at a certain time. It was like known. You go to this place,
this particular sort of shop or dispensary,
yeah,
or
not even under the fucking highway somewhere.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
But that was like the meeting spot. Was 420. At 420, you could go there and you could grab a thing.
So you probably find that because it was in a California or something, it probably made its way into like...
turned into like a meme and started to spread.
It probably worked its way into like some like hip-hop lyric or like...
It
just became a thing.
Exactly.
Okay, so people around the world celebrate 420
out of that
as the sort of celebration of marijuana.
Yeah, so you smoke up at 420 at 20 past 4.
So you must have had this film ready for a while, but did you say, I want it to come out on 420?
I wish I could say that was me, but Netflix called it.
Oh, they were like, we should put it out on 420.
I was like, because we delivered the film to them last year, sort of towards the end of last year, and I was just like, all right, let's get this out. Like, it's been...
let's just do it as soon as possible.
And then we got word that, no, they're holding out. They want to do it. They want to release it 420 next year. And I was like, fuck, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
So I was like, all right, we'll wait it out.
Yeah.
Damn it. But yeah, no, it was worth it. It's a super cool. I love that.
It's
cool
a nice
that
little
in
joke
it.
As well, because it's not popular that everyone knows 420, but
exactly.
It's one of those, if you know, you know.
That's it. Exactly.
Okay.
So that's, and it's kind of like, that's sort of how the whole film is, I think. There's a lot of little in jokes and things that I'm just like, I just threw everything out there, and yeah, those who get it will get it. Those who don't will be like, what the fuck is this? So,
oh, lovely, man.
You know, but yeah.
Lovely, dude. Thanks for the visit.
Thank you, sir, for having me.
Thanks for the chat. It was lovely to catch up.
Awesomeness, man. Yeah, great setup here.
And best of luck with the film, and yeah, on to the next, I'm sure.
Always, definitely.
Yeah, lovely. Cheers, man.
Have a good one.
All right, what a good chat. What a great dude. As we said, Soweto Blaze is on Netflix. Let us know what you think of it. And thanks for listening. Our home base is thevideostore.co.za, and you can find links to other episodes. Every Tuesday, we have a chat just as us, as guys behind the counter, and then on Thursdays are these kinds of episodes where we've got a guest popping in. All right, thank you for listening. And we will see you again next week.
Schwacke.
Lecker.
We panicked. I panicked.